My mission is simple, to make you money. I'm here to level the playing field for all investors. There's always a bull market somewhere, and I promise to help you find it. Mad Money starts now.
Hey, I'm Cramer. Welcome to Mad Money. Welcome to Cramerica. Other people, my friends, I'm just trying to make you a little money. My job, not just to entertain, but to educate, teach you. So call me at 1-800-743-CBC. Tweet me at Jim Cramer. Now, look, if you took your cue from the action in Meta platforms, you would have sold big cap tech immediately. And you know what? You would have been terribly wrong. That's because Meta's trillionaire rivals, Alphabet and Microsoft, reported two of the absolute very best quarters I have ever seen in ages, just last night. Now, they're both spending like mad on artificial intelligence and the cloud and search, just as Meta is, but there's enough business for all of them. Throw in some tepid inflation data that kept the hopes alive for a rate cut, and the market just roared, the Dow gaining 154 points, S&P jumping 1.02%.
House of pleasure.
And then the Nasdaq surging 2.03%. I like that. Now, it makes for a good setup, maybe one of the toughest weeks we've seen in ages. And that's because it's loaded with earnings and we have a Fed meeting and also the later report on Friday. I am already exhausted by next week. Let's take the week in sequence, starting with Sunday night. I usually don't do this, but Bill Whitaker from 60 Minutes interviews Jensen Huang, the CEO of NVIDIA. Normally, I wouldn't care about non-business news shows. Absolutely. This time, though, I bet it could have impact on the stock. Because so many people are fascinated by NVIDIA that I think they want to own it and they want to know more about it. And I say, maybe be prepared for a Monday bump from 60 Minutes. Now, Monday, we hear from the company I get the most questions about. It's called SoFi, S-O-F-I. This one's become a tortured stock, people, where the numbers keep getting better, but the share price doesn't go anywhere because of its convoluted balance sheet. We're issuing equity as additive to earnings, but it crushes the stock anyway. I think there'll be some mystified analysts on the call, including those who will ask, okay, what does the president's student loan forgiveness program have to do with SoFi's earnings to profile? Now, I honestly don't know the answer to that, so I'm going to be listening too, and I will fill you in. We also get a flash from Domino's Pizza, where newest CEO Russell Weiner has really brought back the old Pat Doyle magic. I expect one more great set of numbers because Domino's has execution that's second only to Chipotle, and that is a high bar. Tuesday, wow, okay, Oh, don't you love this? This is about losing weight, and this is about gaining weight. Okay, Tuesday, we find out exactly how well the GLP-1 diabetes and weight loss drugs are selling when Eli Lilly reports. Now, I expect great numbers because Lilly's constantly sold out of Zepbound, which is the version of the drug aimed at obesity, although the lack of product might actually cause some analysts to be concerned. In other words, they could actually miss on the top line because they can't make it fast enough. Now, we want to hear about the procedure for more comments from the FDA on Lilly's Alzheimer's drug. It's more important even as Biogen's competing product is already starting to get some traction. We're going to be pressing Lilly to see something about that drug. We do hear from McDonald's, too, and I like to think that they'll address how they raise prices perhaps too much. Hey, maybe they need to roll them back. I think the incremental series of price hikes has really turned off customers. I don't think it's the great taste, although in the end, we're Wendy's Baconator household. Also on Tuesday, American Express. They got a full day analyst meeting on the heels of what was one of the greatest quarters where the stocks just kept going up and up. I bet this meeting will be a blockbuster. Amex is probably doing everything right, okay? After the close, we get results from a host of important companies. The biggest is Amazon. Will it be like fellow megacap Meta platforms where heavy AI spending fell the stock, or will it be more like Microsoft or Alphabet, which gave you unbelievably good cloud numbers, so nobody cared about the spending? Alphabet also put up some excellent ad numbers for YouTube. I wonder if Amazon saw the same thing from their ad business. I know Amazon's spending like NVIDIA chips like there's no tomorrow, but these guys don't do anything unless they know they have the customers first. On top of that, I'd like to find out if Amazon has lowered the cost of sending packages to you. By the way, that's the key metric for an upside surprise. Starbucks reports, ooh, intriguing. We were on 10 hooks about this position. Jeff Marks and I, when we did our CNBC Investing Club Wednesday, has China gotten better? Have they solved the throughput issues that have dogged both breakfast and the afternoon? Will they face up to the fact that there are too many variations of coffees? How's labor? Have the misdirected pro-Palestine boycott subsided as people realize that Starbucks has no connection to Israel? Can't believe it's come to this. But it did hurt the numbers last time thanks to customer intimidation. I know it's just China in my mind, but everybody's got the whole gauntlet I just mentioned. Let's see. I don't know the answer. We are longing for the trust, and I'm nervous. Call me nervous. Wednesday morning, we find out about CVS and has whether been able to avoid the maelstrom of Humana, managed care, or Walgreens, a drugstore chain whose stock just can't stop going down. This is a tough road, not made easy by the fact of what I call the theft epidemic. Maybe they should have thought about that before installing all those self-checkout kiosks. What's the role of a drugstore when Andy Jassy from Amazon is doing his best to take the customers that go there and reorient them to Prime, with many have same-day delivery for these kinds of things that they sell at CVS? Pfizer reports too, and we're getting used to disappointment here. I want to see what the company's harvesting from its acquisition of Seagen, that's the old Seattle Genetics, which had an amazing anti-cancer franchise. We've seen what Keytruda has done for Merck. I want Seagen to do the same for Pfizer, but that is a tall order. We also get results from Marriott, and this company's been a reliable source of upside surprises. I expect the same thing this time. Somehow the analysts just refuse to believe that Marriott's great numbers can continue. I bet they will, as we've become a much more travel-oriented society. Remember, we travel less goods, more travel, okay? You want a company that's giving you endless earnings beats? It's a little guy. I'm bringing it out, though, because I think you can still make money on its Wingstop. I keep thinking the stock will go down so I can recommend it, but it just won't. You know what? That's often the way of a fantastic stock. On Wednesday afternoon, Fed Chief Jay Powell shares with you the musings of the Open Market Committee. Has those dreadful press conferences. I suspect we'll hear more chatter about rates staying higher for longer, even as I believe from the empirical work that I do, and anecdotal, frankly, that the economy was weaker than most people think in the month of March. I think there are enough brown shoots, mad money speak for signs of weakness, that we're at risk if the Fed actually goes all conventional wisdom and starts talking down rate cuts. That'd be bad for the market. I'm concerned the Fed will stay too restrictive because they don't yet realize the economy has truly started slowing. I think that it started slowing just when they kind of gave up and thought it would never start slowing. It happens. After the close Wednesday, we have Carvana, which we covered last week. The stock's on the move. And there's a monster short position. I can't believe they didn't cover. That was foolish. Anything good will cause a short squeeze, and that will lead to another leg higher, even though the other used car companies did not do that well. Thursday is Apple Day. I don't even bother to mention other companies because this is what matters. Now, Apple is going to have a disappointment. It's the most telegraphed disappointment in Apple's history. So there's so much negativity that you have to wonder if a shortfall is still a shortfall. So somebody's going to call them a shortfall is a shortfall is a shortfall, when everyone knows it's coming. The stock's been creeping higher anyways. It's getting further away from my 160 downside target. Two things could help the Apple cause. First, it could do a rest of world ROW rubric, which would jump, let's lump all the countries that aren't China or the United States together and make people understand the scale of the international opportunity, which is bigger than China. Second, a tie-up with NVIDIA that would help along the Vision Pro as a piece of hardware for the enterprise, not just the consumer, would be terrific. Whole construction companies, auto dealers, and realtors would boost their sales if they embraced it. But Apple is a consumer company. They would have to change their stripes to do what I just said. They should. Finally, on Friday, we get the employment number. And you know what? This one is real tricky. If it's a strong number, we'll think that the Fed never should have stopped raising rates. If it's a soft number, we'll want to know why the Fed talked about keeping rates higher for longer at the meeting. It is what I call fraud. Not a way to end the week. But you need to know it's coming. Bottom line, we have to run another ridiculous gauntlet next week that I have no idea how to play out, but I sure hope it plays out like we saw today. But I do think the economy is getting weaker. I just hope the Federal Reserve has noticed. Fed, brown shoots. But, you know, why don't we start? Let's go to Ryan in Virginia. Ryan.
Oh, yeah, Jim. Jim, I want to get your thoughts on a retail stock that has been decimated. Is VF Corporation a falling knife or a great company that's going to turn things around?
This is a very dicey one. I'll tell you why. Because there's a guy in there, Bracken Darrell, who is sensational. I mean, just absolutely. We loved him at Logitech. He's P&G. He's got real horse sense. But we have to get a clearing event. We have to see all the inventory gone. We do not have that done yet. Once we get sure that all the inventory is gone, then I will probably sound the bye, bye, bye. I can't do it yet. I say we go right now, clear across the country. I say we go to Tyler in California. Tyler.
Big booyah from California. How you doing, Jim?
I think that was more than one person, frankly. I'm doing well. How about you, Tyler?
I'm doing good. Thank you for asking. Hey, what's your look on Dexcom?
Look, I know Dexcom's great. I absolutely know that it can be done in conjunction with the GOP-1s, that it is not the enemy of the GOP-1s, but I don't want to have to defend it because I have to defend some. I just finished defending Starbucks. He who defends all defends none. All right, get ready for the gauntlet next week. If the economy's getting worse, let's hope the Fed is at least paying attention and not throwing their hands up and saying, I guess we couldn't do it after all. Mad Money Tonight. You know them for your credit score. What is your FICO number anyway? I'm thinking of the quarter that sent the stock lower today to see if investors are getting popped in the data analyst company because the stock almost never goes down. Hey, then you called on Western Union. You know what I said I had to do? I said I had to do a little homework. Done the research. I'm ready to turn in my homework with the help of Ben Stoto. And S&P Global turned a solid quarter yesterday to the top of the street's estimates. I'm learning more about what's working with the company's top brands. What a stock that is. So stay with Cramer.
Don't miss a second of Mad Money. Follow at Jim Cramer on X. Have a question? Tweet Cramer. Hashtag Mad Mentions. Send Jim an email to madmoney@cnbc.com or give us a call at 1-800-743-CNBC. Miss something? Head to madmoney.cnbc.com.
All right, we got some work to do here because we got to figure out what the heck just happened to the Fair Isaac Corporation stock, the analytics software and service company best known for being the keeper of the FICO score, Fair Isaac. After a really hot start earlier in the year, the stock came down substantially over the past few weeks thanks to worries about rising interest rates. Higher rates translate into less borrowing, which means less business for Fair Isaac, theoretically. Last night, something interesting happened. The company reported a fantastic quarter, sizable top and bottom line beat, with accelerating revenue growth. Management also raised their full-year forecast across the board. I loved it. Unfortunately, the stock got hit, plunging more than $80, or almost 7% today, because even though Fair Isaac raised its guidance, it wasn't enough to catch up with Wall Street's estimates. See, people already expected a beat and raise quarter, and they're still very much worried about the long-term interest rates going higher. So could this be the buying opportunity we've waited for a high-quality company that very rarely comes down? Let's check in with Will Lansing. He's the CEO of Fair Isaac to get a better sense of the situation. Mr. Lansing, welcome back to Mad Money.
Thanks so much, Jim.
All right, so Will, let's just deal with this right up front. I mean, to me, all of your metrics were exceeded, and it was really a quite beautiful quarter for FICO.
We agree.
Well, I mean, then why do you like my analysis that perhaps you didn't raise earnings enough, estimates enough, that they were unhappy? So, they being people who really don't understand your company as far as I'm concerned?
Well, I'd say the part of your analysis I certainly agree with is that there's a buying opportunity here. That's the part I agree with. And I agree also that the numbers are fine. I mean, we beat guidance and we beat consensus and we're happy with the results. I do think that there's a little bit of an overhang from a fear of interest rates not coming down quickly enough. Earlier in the year, certainly people thought the rates would come down sooner. And with lower rates come higher mortgage score volumes, which is good for us. So any kind of postponement and rate decline is obviously going to clip us a little bit. But generally, we're very happy with the business. We're in a good place.
Okay, look, and I agree with you that it's the hire for longer, trap people, and that gets people who I think are a little too small-minded about your stock, gets them to do something that I disagree with, which is not love your stock. But I also have in my hand a letter from a fellow by the name of Senator Josh Hawley. Now, I was brought up by my mom and dad to think that because there's only 100 senators, you better revere them. But when I read his letter, which was to Jonathan Cantor, the assistant attorney general, he's talking about monopolies. Well, there are more people doing what you're doing than ever before. It's just you have the best one. Why can't this senator see that that's what's going on?
When you are exactly right. I mean, we don't have a monopoly. There are alternatives to the FICO score. But what we do have is the best score and the lowest cost and best way of evaluating credit for a broad population at the low cost. And so, there are people who get concerned about our level of success because we do have a lot of market share and we are widely used. Over 90% of credit decisions in banks in the U.S. are driven by FICO scores. So there's a reason that people notice it. But as you point out, there are alternatives, and we're there because we're good, not because we have some kind of special privileges.
Well, also, look, there was a period where a lot of these upstart companies came on, and that's actually using the analog in the name, that said, hey, listen, they don't do 360. They just drill down on one thing. You got a 360 product, too. From what I can tell, it's better than anybody's.
That's exactly right as well. So you have to distinguish between the scores and the software. We have two businesses, scores and software. And at the end of the day, what we try to do with both of them is make these superior credit decisions. The scores is a low-cost, broad population approach. And the software says, let's take into account lots more inputs into the decision, a little more sophisticated, a little fancier, a little more complicated, and a somewhat more predictive decision as a result. We have both available. And so it's important to compare apples with apples. You know, that there are a lot of fintechs who have new technology for making credit decisions. Typically, they start with a FICO score, and then they build on top of that with whatever their secret sauce is.
Well, that's what I thought. I mean, we discussed, say, an outfit like an Upstart. I mean, they're not, no one's impeding them. They could be in every bank if they were better than you. I mean, I think a senator may just look at the situation. There have been more competitors that have been created that tell me, listen, they've got the algorithms and FICO doesn't. That I understand this maybe 10 years ago when the competitors weren't around and you were the best. But now this is the most competition I've ever have you seen. And yet you're winning constantly. And that's what matters.
That's absolutely right. That is right. Look, the FICO score is going to be used for a very long time. It is the most predictive, low-cost way to evaluate the creditworthiness of a large population. We do it. We do it at low cost for our bank customers. And, you know, what I'm proud of is it enables us to get credit into the hands of almost anyone who can responsibly handle it. We score more people. We get credit into the hands of the people who deserve it. And you know, I'm proud of that.
Well, the only reason I'm dwelling on is that your stock did get hit on the letter because people, I think, are a little unsophisticated by your situation. They seem to think that you make a ton of money per mortgage. I mean, the fact is, you take about 20 basis points. I mean, you can't even see it.
That's also true. Now, it is the case that mortgage scores, FICO mortgage scores, are pulled for almost every mortgage, both conforming mortgages and non-conforming mortgages. But the FICO score is a percent of the total fees that a consumer pays for mortgages is tiny, 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 tiny.
Now, one of the things I did do over the longest period of time was to see what's happened when your stock has had this drop. And I know you should be very proud. Every single time when you have this big a drop, it's been an amazing buying opportunity. I don't see anything else other than the fact that I think it was a mistaken sell-off. And I say that this is right. And I know you agree with me that, but I'm not kidding. You know, every single one of the sharp dips has been accompanied by a multi-year rise. And I think this is just another one of them.
I think that's exactly right. That's, you're spot on. Inevitably, you know, there's bumps and dips in a stock. Ours has generally been up, 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 and up. And most people have trouble getting a hold of the stock because they find the PE exorbitant. You know, we think that it's fairly priced based on our future prospects. But when you get a dip like this, it's certainly an opportunity.
Right, one last question. You have not been contacted by Mr. Cantor's office, have you, the antitrust office?
No. And I think it's probably worth pointing out that there was an antitrust investigation by the Department of Justice several years ago, and we came out clean. I mean, there is not anything inappropriate here. We're squeaky clean on competitive practices. And there's nothing to be concerned about.
All right, terrific. Because that was the only other thing I said was, well, maybe they reached out and we don't know about it. But I didn't think, I know you would have disclosed it immediately. You disclose everything. You're a totally upfront company. Every footnote answers every question. So I want to thank Will Lansing, Fair Isaac Corp, President and CEO. We love this stock. But this is our chance. It's the first break.
Thank you.
Thank you, Will. Good to talk to you. Everybody's back into the break.
Coming up, you asked and we answered. Kramer turns in homework on a classic American company. Next.
Last Thursday night, we got a call from Corey in Washington. He wanted to know about Western Union, the 173-year-old money transfer company. I had to confess that I hadn't followed this one for a very, very long time, aside from wondering how the heck Western Union could have sunk to the point where it now has a nearly 7% dividend yield. So I promised to take a fresh look at it and circle back after the company reported earlier this week. Western Union has a long and storied history, but the Western Union of today only regained its independence after it was spun off by First Data Corporation 18 years ago. Back then, the company was mostly focused on cross-border money transfers. Over time, they've embraced new technology to make it easier for people to move money overseas. After getting hit during the Great Recession, the stock gradually made a comeback before peaking in February of 2020, right before COVID hit. Problem is, the pandemic crushed international travel, which meant much less demand for these cross-border money transfers. Meanwhile, Western unions faced all sorts of old competition, including from cryptocurrency. After peaking at $28 in 2020, the stock came down to 10 bucks in March of last year. Now, during the period, Western Union has never stopped struggling to take control of its own destiny. In 2021, they sold a non-core business to Business Unit, and then they brought in a new CEO from Fiserv, a great company. His name was Devin McGranahan. About a year later, he laid out a new strategy to combine the company's long-separated technology and retail money transfer business. In the old days, people would just go to Western Union to make a single money transfer. Now they're trying to embrace a more relationship-centric business model with their tech offerings like digital banking services, keeping customers engaged between visits. Basically, they've been losing share to rival fintech plays, so they decided to get into fintech themselves and use their huge network of stores to give them an edge. Now, at the time, Western Union was realistic about the fact that any kind of turnaround would take some time. They introduced some long-term financial targets in October 2022. They're pretty modest, targeting 2% revenue growth by 2025, paired with operating margin roughly in line with what they were already doing at the time, and mid-single-digit earnings growth. Now, I know, not exactly impressive, not a high bar, but at least the numbers wouldn't be shrinking anymore. 6 months later, the stock finally did manage a bottom after still one more ugly quarter. And over the past 13 odd months, it's worked its way from $10 to $13 and change. So why has Western Union been doing better of late? Simple. The stabilization plan is working. In fact, on Wednesday night, the company just reported its fifth solid to good quarter in a row. Last May, they delivered a top and bottom line beat and reiterated their full-year forecast. Last July, they had another top and bottom line beat coupled with a raise forecast. Western Union gave you the same kind of beat and raise last October. By the beginning of this year, these guys had some real accomplishments. Western Union's full-year 2023 numbers were much better than the light initial guidance that they provided in October 2022. Full-year 2023 revenues was down 4% on constant currency basis. Their operating margin came in at the middle of what they guided for, and their earnings per share came in at a whopping $1.74. Management originally predicted they were going to be earning $1.60. Retail transaction growth was flat year over year, with revenue growth of 1%. Again, for Western Union, flat is an improvement. New branded digital customers grew by 13%. That's not bad. Digital transactions were up 11%, double digit. Company also rolled out new digital wallet offerings along with debit cards and lending services in several additional markets. And they made progress on the cost cut front, too. That said, when Western Union reported its fourth quarter numbers roughly 3 months ago, Wall Street didn't love it. Because while the sales were better than expected, the earnings were merely in line after three straight quarters of big upside surprises. Management's full-year forecast for 2024 also seemed lackluster. But with this new Western Union led by CEO Devin McGranahan, it's clear that the company likes to underpromise with its guidance and then overdeliver with its actual results. UPOT! Sure enough, on Wednesday night, the company reported a pretty good first quarter. Western Union posted a slight revenue beat with a 3% growth on a constant currency basis, and they earned 45 cents per share when Wall Street was looking for just 41. That's nearly 5% earnings growth. Again, not too impressive in the grand scheme of things, but pretty darn good for something that's widely regarded as a no-growth business. Western Union also raised its full-year revenue and earnings forecast pretty substantially. It's now looking like 2024 will be an up year. In response, the stock initially soared in after-hour trading, but then it got dragged down by the negative tape yesterday. I understand that. It finished the session down more than 2%. Today, the stock bounced a bit, but it's still below where it was before the quarter. I kind of like that. Now, taking a step back, I find it encouraging that Western Union's core money transfer business is making a comeback. Total transactions growth and cross-border volumes have now been positive for four straight quarters. Meanwhile, their branded digital transactions have consistently been growing at a double-digit clip over the same period. All good. So where do I come down on Western Union first? I agree with Cody in Washington. There's a legitimate turn going on here. And the new management team at Western Union deserves credit for making it all happen. I also like the fact that the stock does remain very cheap, currently selling for less than 8 times the midpoint of management's full-year earnings forecast. I like that. That's kind of really inexpensive. The stock has an excellent dividend yield. It's a legit 7% payout, and I think you can trust it, as Western Union's balance sheet is fine. Over time, I believe the stock can grind higher, assuming there are no real setbacks to the turnaround effort, and there certainly haven't been any setbacks so far. So if for some reason you're in love with Western Union, I think you can justify buying here, but, and this is a big but, it's not a position that I'd be excited about. I definitely wouldn't recommend a reclamation project like Western Union over a payments company with real growth and a nice, exciting future, like, say, American Express. For some perspective, Western Union is working toward a target of 2% revenue growth and mid-single-digit earnings growth next year. Amex, long aim for 10% plus revenue growth and mid-teens earnings growth. You figure which one you like more. Visa reported a nice quarter the other day, and its shares got a solid pop over the long haul. Visa and MasterCard have been much better performers than Western Union. But by the way, those two also have plenty of cross-border volume. So let me give you the bottom line. Western Union, is it a turnaround story? Absolutely. Can the stock go higher from its current depressed level? I think so. But in the end, I think you can do better with a Visa or a MasterCard or most certainly an American Express. Let's go to Joe in Georgia. Joe.
Booyah, Kramer. Longtime listener, first time caller.
Fantastic, Joe. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I've got a question about MasterCard. I really like this stock. And I'm a little apprehensive about buying in at these levels. What do you think? Should I buy in now or wait for a pullback?
I think this is, I mean, I saw them the other day. They were here ringing the bell. I think this is a terrific level. I think you should buy some here and then wait and buy some lower. But MasterCard is a sensational stock. Made a lot of money for it for the Travel Trust and should never have sold it. That's what, my highest compliment. I think Western Union is a turnaround story in the making that you can make money with. It will go higher, but I think you can do better in the payment space. Watch more in Money Head. We're all about making money here, and sometimes there are companies that fly under the radar that can bring you some big returns. I think S&P Global fits that mold, and I'm breaking down the company with the company's quarter with the excellent CEO. Then one thing saved this week from being a complete meltdown. I'll reveal what it is and how you can get in the action. And, of course, all your calls rapid fire in tonight's edition of the Lightning Round. So stay with Kramer. Every earnings season, all sorts of high-quality companies report good quarters, but still end up flying under the radar. Why? Because there's just too much information to process. Take S&P Global, which is mainly a ratings agency for the bond market, but also runs all the S&P and Dow Jones indices on top of all sorts of offerings about market intelligence institutional money managers need and live by. Yesterday morning, S&P Global reported a strong top and bottom line beat, with management also raising their full-year forecast. But because the action was so ugly yesterday, well, the stock only managed to rally a 0.5% before tacking on another tiny gain today. You know what? I think this is a quarter that deserves more attention, especially with the stock still down more than 5%. This is a high-quality company. Don't take it from me. Let's dig deeper with Doug Peterson. He's the president and CEO of S&P Global, a person I've known for a very long time, to find out how things are going. Well, Doug, first of all, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. It's always an honor to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very kind. I always have to start with the fact that you have this amazing ratings business, but each time I see you, you have more and better other businesses you've added, even in the time since I've seen you last. Talk about some of the new things you've got.
Well, as you know, we did the acquisition of IHS Markit and brought in an incredible portfolio of businesses. We brought in the fixed income indices to put together with S&P Dow Jones indices. We've got this energy suite, which includes incredible conferences. We have all the information you need about alternative energy, about what's happening in hydrogen markets, as well as price benchmarks. And then the market intelligence business, we have 13 million prices now that we can put into all of our products and services.
Well, this is really important because there's a lot of opaque analysis that's done. And then there's your empirical analysis. For instance, we often hear about private credit and how they're doing, but we shouldn't be relying on them. You actually have benchmarks. You actually have the numbers.
Well, we have the numbers, and this is one of the highest growth areas for us. Last quarter, we grew that business 15%, because not only do the actual investors themselves, the private credit managers, want more information about their own credit portfolios, want to look at concentrations, so do the LPs. The LPs are looking for information. So if our ratings business benefits from providing the private credit analytics, securitization analytics, and then in our LP business, we're providing through iLevel information for all of those LPs about the portfolio, and we're we can apply all of that pricing technology we have to the, what's inside of those credit portfolios. It's a win-win for us, and we're really excited about it.
I want people at home to know this. When you had these things, even in my time, the managers made up the numbers. They just would take a look and say, oh, well, this is worth X. That is unfair. And you busted that, which is terrific. At the same time, we got to go into the IHS. You come into that market, and the energy market's gigantic, and it's something we dominate worldwide now. We're dominant. And you become the sole, single sole source of truth for all the big institutions very quickly.
Well, when you think about the energy market, this is one that, as you say, it's quite opaque, but it's also going through a massive transformation. You know, one of the things I say that every single company is an energy company now. Everyone wants to know, what's your energy footprint? What's your carbon analytics? Do you have a net zero pledge? Is that net zero pledge something that anybody can ever get to? We're providing the kind of data and analytics that allows you to run your company as an energy company, understand those analytics, do all of the energy transition financing side of it. So we put together something that goes from the financing side to the energy side to the pricing side across the entire business for multiple investment industries.
Well, there are people who say, look, the interest in ESG has died out. It may not be as fervid, but it's going to be, it's mandated. You have to have it. You can't just like say, oh, nobody cares about it right now. That's not the way it works.
Well, we're in a third inning slump, and we've still got many more innings to go in ESG. And right now, all of the focus is shifted to energy, and it's shifting to environment. It's shifting to climate, to carbon analytics, to carbon markets. And this is where we play a really important part through what we have with Trucost, an acquisition we did many years ago, what we've built through the combination of Platts and the energy business from IHS. So we have those analytics that you need to be able to do the ESG. We also have over 3,000 companies that give us information about their own ESG factors that we can use to help the market understand what's happening.
Well, I think the old days people used to say, was there issuance? Yes, by S&P. If there wasn't issuance, no. But you still have a very big issuance business, and issuance is really on fire.
Well, last quarter, our what we call build issuance went up by 45%, and our transaction revenues went up 54%. So the ratings business revenues last quarter were up 27% overall. And the margin was up very, very substantially, not just for ratings, but the entire company. We had 14% top line growth across the company, organic growth, and we had a 27% EPS. So we had a really, really phenomenal quarter.
Now, how do you find these different acquisitions? For instance, Kensho was something that was interesting, and now you make Kensho into a really profitable business.
Well, Kensho goes back 5 or 6 years ago. We had a vision that artificial intelligence was going to change the way people did their work. We thought that it wasn't going to change roles and jobs, but it was going to allow you to automate things that were underneath what you did and make you smarter and work faster. So we've seen that playing out now. And so we've had Kensho in the company for over 5 years, and we built a Kensho layer of machine learning and analytics using textual data to turn it into actual data you can turn into being able to make decisions on. And now we're applying that to generative AI. We have a whole generative AI roadmap, including products that we've started building and an internal platform we built for ourselves. So we have our own internal platform. By keeping our proprietary data inside of our firewalls, we can bring the models in, and then we're not losing our intellectual property.
That is terrific. And I think people should understand that it is, you're not idle. You are creating things all the time that it turned out that we needed that we didn't know we needed.
Well, we think that there's always going to be some angle of data and analytics that we want to get ahead of. As an example, we actually have an R&D team that's looking at what we call DeFi. It's digital finance. It's for instance, stable coins. We now have a team that assesses the quality and the risk of stable coins. Where is that going to go? Right now it's small, but we want to be on the leading edge of things like this. So we can be at the leading edge of energy transition, of digital finance, what's happening in private credit, et cetera. This is our vision, is to be on the cutting edge and then make sure we protect all of the businesses we have that are so strong.
Oh, that's so great, because there's so many of our viewers want to be in, they desperately want to be in Bitcoin. They want to be in crypto. But the stable coin is the big issue, because we know that it's opaque. You're able to get good information on stable coin?
Well, we have a criteria. It's like, I think it was like a rating criteria. It has literally 30 or 40 different criteria that you have to be able to understand to judge the quality of that stable coin. So we have a stable coin assessment now. We're also rating digital bonds.
Well, you are?
Yeah. If there's digital bonds out there, we have a rating criteria for digital bonds if they're using any kind of a digital technology.
Well, I regard you as the great equalizer between the limited partner or the customer and the company that is doing the thing, because the government itself doesn't have the tools or actually the vision that you have about what people really want.
Well, we see what they also, where they're going. You know, we're trying to stay a step ahead. Some of the things we do don't necessarily work out, but we got to stay ahead of the markets and have this R&D and the investment. And we also know that our business requires us to continuously improve our relationship with our customers. You know, we have to add value, bring better technology. We've been doing a lot of launches across our products the last couple of years to make them better and easier to use all the time.
Well, people should know, I sold a business to Doug multiple years ago, and it's been treated very well. And that's why I do know him, and you are an upstanding business person and a great person to deal with. Thank you so much. That is Doug Peterson. He's the president and CEO of S&P Global, and it's a terrific stock. Mad Money's back after the break.
Coming up, hit us with your best shot. An electrified fast-fire lightning round is next.
And then the lightning round is over. Are you ready? Scheme down. It's time for the lightning round. Crazy. You know what? I say we start with Hutch in New York. Hutch.
Hey, Jim. It's Hutch.
What's going on, partner?
See what you think about Celsius Holdings.
I'm liking Celsius. It went down because of Monster, but the problem with Monster are really the win for Celsius. And I only had four of them this day. Just four. I cut back. Let's go to Brian in Texas. Brian!
Booyah, Jim. It's a pleasure, sir.
Right back at you.
Was wondering what's your thoughts on Schlumberger ticker.
This was a bummeroony fatty call. I mean, I got to tell you, SLB did not deliver. I feel terrible because I liked the company very much, but it was weak. Actually, Halliburton did better. That's saying something. Don't forget, we like Coterra for the Charitable Trust. How about we go to Rhonda in Kansas? Rhonda.
Hey, Jim. How are you?
I'm good. How about you?
I am well, Jim. Diamondback Energy.
It is so good. I should have mentioned that along with Coterra. Diamondback, I saw they were debated, did like a bull bear debate earlier on on our show, our network, and then kind of came out and said, well, maybe it's good and maybe it's bad. No, it's great. All right, let's go to work here. Let's go to Edna in New York. Edna.
Booyah, Mr. Kramer.
Booyah, Edna. What's happening?
How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I've been increasing my shares of Coterra, and I still have shares of PXD. Would you recommend that I sell or wait until I get Exxon?
Darn it. Exxon stock was down today, and it hurt Pioneer. I want you to ka-ching, okay? You ka-ching, and you get to the Coterra. You get to the Coterra, man. I think it'll be good for you. I need to go to James in New York. James.
Hey, Jim, I'm calling. First of all, I love your show. Huge fan.
Thank you.
Made me a lot of money over the years.
Yes.
Love your thoughts on the next big thing in the fight against cancer. I called you before it was approved, but now it's been approved, booyah. Anktiva, Immunity Bio.
Yeah, I know. I think someone's going to have to pick them up. I mean, because everyone needs a cancer. Look at what Merck's done. Look at how much money Merck's made. Merck is a great, honest company. Rob Davis doing a terrific job, but I agree with you. I'm with you. I am with you, partner. Let's go to Larry in Oklahoma. Larry!
Booyahski, Jim.
Oh, booyah.
I want to ask your opinion on a company that's dropped 15% in the last month, made a recent deal with Oracle, and its earnings come out again on May 6th. You know who I'm talking about. Palantir.
Oh, look, I like Palantir. But you know what? They become uncommunicative for me on the show. That doesn't bias me. I'm a fine man. I'm a good man. But I wish they'd come on because I do like the stock. Let's go to Josiah in Florida. Josiah.
I have a question as far as PRB, because I've seen many ups and downs on it.
Yeah, it is ups and downs. That's why if you want the insurance business, I'm going to send you Progressive. I think Progressive's better. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the conclusion of the Lightning Round.
The Lightning Round is sponsored by Charles Schwab. Coming up, Kramer puts a bow on the Dow's wild week. Don't start your weekend without hearing his final Friday thoughts. Next.
Look, we know what saved us this week. The demand for artificial intelligence input that boosted the fortunes of Alphabet and Microsoft. Demand for AI is so strong that it's reverberating throughout the whole country. You know, it's triggering data center revolution, huge construction everywhere, a growth of power use that hasn't happened in years. Most important, the need for semiconductors. Traders lapped up Broadcom and Supermicro and Arm Holdings. Those are all good analogs, but the most notable move of them all came from what's become, I think, one of the most controversial stocks in the entire market.
Sell.
The stock of NVIDIA. Case in point, size. Nobody seemed to think it mattered all that much when Alphabet stock passed the $2 trillion mark, right? I mean, surely it's been weak lately, but when a company does a $70 billion buyback, gives you a 20-cent quarterly dividend, it's only fair for the stock to rally 10%. It's been around, though. It's flirted with these levels before. Totally rational. Microsoft's been the market alpha dog for ages. Ever since Apple's iPhone sales stalled and critics dismissed it as a no-growth company. When Microsoft talked about its artificial intelligence business, we learned about that it gave the Azure cloud division an astounding 7% boost. That is incredible. That's OpenAI and ChatGPT. Microsoft also has a terrific Copilot product that's taken the world by storm. And by the way, you might not know it, but pretty soon it's going to come to your PC, maybe July, maybe August. We know these companies are making fortunes. But we often have to be reminded why that's happening. It's in large part because of the solutions made possible by Jensen Huang, the CEO of NVIDIA. I don't know how many of you remember the movie Field of Dreams. If you build it, they will come. It was fiction. If you build a baseball diamond in a cornfield, there's no way that actual baseball stars will show up. But you know what? Jensen Huang pulled a if you build it, they will come story. It's real. He built chips originally to make video games look better, which quickly became much faster than anything else in the market. For several years, they languished as the kind, non-promotional CEO built it. And nobody came. And then one day, his friend Sam Altman came and played ball. The rest is almost fantasy because it just can't be reality, can it? No, it was. In months, ChatGPT went so viral that you could see what's happened by looking at the amazing results of the companies that embraced Jensen Huang's super chips, including the two last night. There's just one problem. Unlike Microsoft or Alphabet, NVIDIA, the stock, basically came out of nowhere. The idea that this company has a $2.2 trillion valuation just rankles people. It's regarded as alchemy, some sort of gossamer gain, a fluke that will eventually be undone. Unlike its fellow trillionaires, Apple, Alphabet, and Microsoft, it just doesn't seem right that a company could sneak into that esteemed group through the back door. It's like people think NVIDIA didn't pay its dues, even though it's been in business for 31 years. They don't know how long Jensen's been working on this project. They don't know that he is the ultimate dues payer. I'm not asking you to believe that if Jensen built it with all the earnest nature and optimism the companies will call the hyperscalers will come. But I am asking you to stop doubting it just because you only discovered the stock a year or two ago. Now, NVIDIA still has plenty of critics. The stock's about 100 points from its high. If it doesn't take out that high, I am sure that it'll become suspicious that it will go much lower. That's what the technicians would say. These customers are all working to try to create their own semiconductors. That's true. They might even end up competing with NVIDIA. Although, I can tell you the world is starved for NVIDIA's wares right now. It is sold out of much of what it makes before it even builds it. I say this. Open your mind about this amazing stock and its humble CEO. Sure, it might seem new to you, but if you've been watching the show for a decade, NVIDIA is no stranger. And if you haven't owned it for years now, all I can say is, what took you so long? I like to say, as always, a bull market summer. I promise I'll find it just for you right here on Mad Money. I'm Jim Cramer. See you Monday. Last call starts now.
All opinions expressed by Jim Cramer on this podcast are solely Cramer's opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, or their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by Cramer on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Jim Cramer as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. Cramer's opinions are based upon information he considers reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Mad Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/Mad Money disclaimer.